This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, December 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Since taking office a year ago, the Trump administration has withdrawn the United States from the Paris Climate Accord, canceled its participation in the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership negotiations, slashed foreign aid and contributions to the UN, and gutted the State Department. During Trump's campaign, he often accused China of waging economic war against the U.S. But in his presidency so far, he struck a different tone. Here he is in November during his first trip to Beijing after a long diplomatic meeting with China's leader, Xi Jinping.
Both the United States and China will have a more prosperous future if we can achieve a level economic playing field. Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one. But I don't blame China. After all, who can blame a country for being able to take advantage of another country for the benefit of its citizens? I give China great credit.
Evan Osnos joins me to discuss America's retreat from foreign affairs under Trump and how China is exploiting its absence. Evan, welcome back.
Thanks, Dorothy.
You spent 8 years in Beijing as a foreign correspondent and recently returned to report on a piece for next week's issue of The New Yorker. How does the Trump administration look to China?
In China, a lot of people are frankly very surprised and delighted, actually, by the way the Trump administration has unfolded so far. When he was a candidate, he talked about China taking America's jobs. He said the word he used was that China is raping the United States, and he blamed it for hollowing out the American manufacturing economy. But since he got into office, the dominant fact about America's approach to China has been that it is sort of systematically reducing its presence in the world. It's cutting back its contributions to the UN. It's cutting back its contributions to UN peacekeeping. It's criticizing the World Trade Organization. It's pulling out of Paris, many of the ways that people have heard about. And as it does that, it has created a real opening for China, quite literally an opening. I mean, the way they talk about it in Beijing is they say that this represents a strategic opportunity for China, which will last as long as Trump is in office. And it's really the first moment in history in which China's pursuit of a larger role in the world has coincided with America's pursuit of a smaller role. And for China, that is an extraordinary possibility.
You know, it's interesting to see how perversely this is playing out, at least as far as Trump's initiatives go. China's economy has been growing exponentially, which in recent years I guess explains part of Trump's alarm. Many expect that it's going to slow as we move forward. But even so, it looks likely to eclipse the United States, making it the first non-democratic country in over a century to be the world's largest economy.
Yeah, that's a big transition point on the horizon. And you know, even if China's economy slows down to GDP growth of 3% a year, for instance, which is what a lot of people expect, it will mean that China plays a much larger role in the world just in terms of its economic heft. And then that begins to introduce other opportunities. It can begin to influence the way that other countries organize their own political systems. So, for instance, if they have a choice between choosing American values, things like a free press, an independent judiciary, human rights, democracy, the kinds of things that the United States has more or less represented and projected since World War II, or what China is calling the Chinese solution, the Zhongguo Fang'an, which is something else. It's basically state capitalism. They don't regard human rights as a priority the way the United States does. They believe that the Western liberal order is something that doesn't really suit a lot of countries in the world. And China is now, both because of its economic weight and because the United States is choosing to pull back into this America First mode, it means that other countries are going to be facing a choice of a certain kind. Are they going to line themselves up with China as it projects itself outward, or are they going to stay with the American approach as it turns inward?
But this America First idea and the isolationism we've been talking about, it will have the effect of diminishing and it already is, having the effect of diminishing America's power in the world.
It is diminishing America's power in some pretty specific ways. I'll give you an example. I interviewed the Prime Minister of Singapore recently, whose name is Lee Hsien Loong, and he said, look, we are a stalwart ally of the United States. We have been for many years. But the simple fact is that when the United States withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, it undermined your credibility. And he said to me, he said, you won't see the effects overnight, but the effects are similar to when you draw a red line and then you don't take it seriously. It changes the way that the rest of the world looks at your commitment. That has a profound effect on our ability to achieve our own interests, to persuade other countries to do what we want.
Before Trump went to Beijing, he hosted Xi Jinping at Mar-a-Lago. What did the Chinese take away from that meeting?
The Chinese were very pleased by that meeting. Frankly, they were a little worried going into it. They didn't know what Trump was going to do. They thought he might try to embarrass Xi Jinping by saying something confrontational. In fact, it was very, very much the other way. What the Chinese discovered at Mar-a-Lago was, as they put it later to a former U.S. official, that Trump was receiving a tutorial on a number of issues, things that are usually really difficult between U.S. and China, things like Tibet and Taiwan, these really sensitive issues, North Korea being the best example. On these issues, Donald Trump was not in a position, he frankly didn't really have enough information to be able to push back on China's description, and so he basically accepted their description. In fact, he said as much in an interview later with the Wall Street Journal, where he said, after 10 minutes of speaking with Xi Jinping, I realized it was not as easy as I thought, talking about North Korea. And after the Mar-a-Lago summit, a Chinese think tank, an influential institution called the Pangol Institution, did an analysis of the Trump White House. And they said that the Trump administration has a few factions. There's the anti-establishment group, which is around Steve Bannon. This was back before he was fired. Then there's the professionals, as they called it. That was James Mattis and a couple of the other longtime government public servants. But they said the most important group, the most important faction in the White House was what they called the Trump family clan. They were referring, of course, to Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, who have senior positions in the White House. And what they said was that the Trump White House appears to practice something called jia tian xia, which is a really obscure Chinese term. You don't hear about it much. It comes from ancient China. And what it means is to treat the state as your possession. And that is how Beijing has come to understand the Trump White House in some ways.
So tell us a little bit about the Belt and Road Initiative, which was already well underway before Trump took office, and what that represents to China's future and to the future of the world.
Yeah, the Belt and Road Initiative is China's biggest effort to try to inscribe its presence around the world. It's basically sort of like the Marshall Plan, which the United States adopted in 1947 to rebuild Europe after World War II. And it meant building literally bridges and roads and so on. In China's case, the Belt and Road Initiative is much larger than the Marshall Plan was. And it extends across Asia and Africa, and in some cases even into Latin America. And it's an opportunity to build physical infrastructure, but also to build these relationships with the government in the hopes of making them more amenable to what China hopes for out of the world, to try to make other countries respond to China's needs. And Belt and Road, in some ways, people haven't been sure what to make of it. You know, there are some serious criticisms of it. People say it lends so much money to some countries that it feels a little bit like a new form of imperialism. There's a lot of wariness in Asia, particularly about what China's intentions are. What I found in talking to people around Asia was that they are wary of Belt and Road, but frankly, Belt and Road is the best game in town right now because the United States is cutting foreign aid. The president's budget, which he proposed in the spring, cuts foreign aid by more than 25%. And Belt and Road is going in the opposite direction. And as the Prime Minister of Singapore said to me, you have to respond when that kind of opportunity is presented to you. And right now, China is the source of that opportunity.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
We know how Trump admires autocrats, and you write in your piece, which listeners will be able to see next week rather than right now, you write in the piece that Xi Jinping has the kind of presidency that Trump would prefer. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I was quite struck by it, being back in Beijing recently, that Xi Jinping is enjoying a period of really extraordinary power and almost unimpeded authority at the moment. He was just reinstated for another five-year term. His name has been written into the constitution of the Communist Party. He's only the third person in Chinese history to have that distinction. Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, and now Xi Jinping, which means that really it doesn't matter what job he holds. As long as he's alive, he'll be the most authoritative person in China because nobody else will have that distinction. But really, almost on a sort of granular level, I was struck by the number of ways in which Xi Jinping has powers that Donald Trump would clearly enjoy, one of which was that Xi Jinping was able to exclude Western news organizations that he doesn't much like from a big press conference recently. He just kept them out. And then the next day, there was a photo of Xi on the front page of all the big state party newspapers. And the photo was really sort of glorious. It had been airbrushed and perfected to the point that he just looked exactly as he would want to look. And of course, as we know, Donald Trump has been frustrated by his representations in the media, both in print and then also in photos. He thinks that they have it out for him. And I think in some ways he does look at the job that Xi Jinping has and thinks, well, that looks like the kind of presidency that is really worth having.
Well, and they played to this when he went to Beijing. They rolled out all the pageantry, and you got there just after Trump had left. What did you hear from people?
They had decided that they would give President Trump a big, special welcome. They called it a state visit plus. And Americans with senior Chinese contacts had been advised in advance that they were really going to pull out all the stops, as one person put it to me. They believe he is uniquely susceptible to that kind of treatment, meaning that this is actually an ancient playbook in China. If you go back to the 19th century, there was a Manchu prince named Qing who actually wrote down his techniques for handling foreigners. And what he said was the barbarians really respond to receptions and entertainment. He says afterwards, they're very appreciative. When Trump arrived, he was given a personal tour of the Forbidden City. He was told this was the first time that a Chinese president had done this for a foreign leader. And sure enough, when they made their first public appearance together, the first thing he did was that he thanked President Xi for this magnificent welcome. And I think, look, every foreign president has to thank their host in China for giving them a great show. But anybody who's followed China over the years knows that this was a radical break from the way that they dealt with Obama, for instance, or with previous presidents. This was a kind of five-star luxury presidential visit, which was very much intended to try to make sure that Trump was close to them.
Listening to you, reading your piece, and thinking about all this, it reminds me that for decades and decades, the reigning theory has been that without a democratic society with free press and greater respect of human rights, countries like China will always lag behind Western democracies. Is that now being disproved, or are there limits to what China can accomplish?
Right. Actually, there's a big rethinking going on. It's not that people have begun to say that you can build a society without human rights and without democracy and have it be admired. No, the truth is, in many ways, the rest of the world still looks kind of warily at China. Ordinary citizens do. But China has been able to defy Western expectations that it would eventually become more like the United States or more like the West. The truth is, China is becoming simply more like China. It is also now seeking to try to offer that as an option to the rest of the world. And that's a real shift.
And China's, you know, moving right ahead on technology. They seem to be outpacing the United States in certain fields.
They are closing the gap. Look, for a long time, the U.S. has had a huge advantage on China when it comes to new technologies. And Silicon Valley's got these great advantages of, you know, being able to collaborate and protect intellectual property. But what we're finding now is that some really important people in Silicon Valley are warning that China has closed the gap much faster than Americans realize, and actually some of the choices America's making right now is going to give China a pretty big boost. Eric Schmidt, who's the chairman of Google, said recently that if the U.S. government continues to cut spending on basic science research, which it has done under the proposed Trump budget, that it will essentially be ceding the ground on artificial intelligence to China. As he put it, China will eventually pull ahead of us within the next decade or a decade and a half. There is a real feeling that that this moment, this kind of like two countries passing each other on adjoining railways, just heading in opposite directions, is happening almost without Americans realizing it. But people in all of these different specialties, whether it's in foreign affairs or in technology, are beginning to notice this transition. And I think people are starting to talk about it more publicly.
Critics of Obama like to say that his foreign policy could be characterized as leading from behind. How would you characterize Trump's foreign policy at this point in his administration?
I think Trump's foreign policy has to be understood as retreating from the front. In a sense, what he's doing is, with great gusto and confidence, he is systematically pulling the United States back from the positions of leadership that it has occupied since World War II. And he's not doing it with apologies. No, he's quite sure that what he's doing is the right thing.
So the Bannon wing, its presence is felt. I mean, he still talks to Bannon. That's very much the isolationist perspective that Bannon brought with him into the White House.
There was definitely an element of Bannon's worldview there. But I also think some of this is also a reflection of another element of the Trump agenda, which was trying to cut costs. So, for instance, cutting a third out of the budget of the State Department, or really cutting back on foreign aid. These kinds of things are another piece of Trump's campaign rhetoric that he's now following up on. But it's lasted long after Steve Bannon left the White House. This is very much a part of Trump's core vision for how he wants to see the United States operate in the world. And that's where I think actually the sort of the long-term effect of this is really interesting, which is that Donald Trump, whether he calls it this or not, is ushering the United States into a period in which it's no longer a single superpower the way it has been for really the years since the Cold War, but is instead now back into a period of great power rivalry, where you've got big countries like China and Russia and the U.S., all contending with each other at much more of an equal footing than they did just a few years ago.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer and the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. We'll be off next week and wish everyone a peaceful, happy holiday. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This program was produced by Jill Dubuff for newyorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.